It's really a delight having you here, and as you could see when you came in, a number of my colleagues were also
That's awfully
thrilled.
Sweet of them to wear that badge.
And,
did you send them round there with dire warnings that you expected them to wear them? Otherwise?
Oh, no. Well, it was our idea, however, Pinoff did provide the buttons.
Well, if it's your idea, Don, I thought it was very charming and very sweet.
So I'm going to have to ask you some pronunciations, first of all, because we see these names in print, but sometimes we're not exactly sure how to pronounce the names. For example, the name of the Prime Minister who was murdered at the beginning of A Taste of Death. Can you pronounce his name for me so I have a definitive pronunciation?
Well, I think he's Barone, but I got this out of Shakespeare, and I've never met anybody in real life called Barone, but I think that's how he would pronounce it.
Now, most of us refer to the commander as Dalgleish.
That's
that correct?
Absolutely correct.
Scottish?
It is Scottish. I hardly realized, I must have realized at the time, but I haven't made him into much of a Scot, have I? I named him after my English teacher at school. She was a Miss Dalgleish.
What was she like?
No, she was all right. She was quite a fierce lady, but she was a very good teacher, and I owed her a lot.
Fond memories of her. Huh?
Very fond memories.
It's incredible when you think about it, the influence that teachers have on us when we're young,
both
to the good and the bad.
Indeed.
I don't know how you felt, but Miss Dalgleish must have had a positive impact on you. I remember English teachers who did, and English teachers to this date, like Miss Kiley, that I just cannot abide. The thought makes me shudder. Did she influence you in terms of wanting to be a writer in any way?
I don't think she influenced me in that way, because I knew I wanted to be a writer from the age of about 7 or 8. But she just encouraged my love of literature and my love of words.
Since 7 or 8?
Oh, yes. Since I was a very little girl, I knew I wanted to be a writer. I can remember a conversation with a friend of my father's who'd come to a meal at the house, you know. And he said, "What are you going to be when you grow up?" Sort of silly question that children get asked even at 7 or 8. And I said, "I want to be a writer. I want to write books." And he's interested. And I thought I'd ask him a few questions. So I said, "Well, when you've written your book, you know, how do you get in the shop?" And he explained to me about people called publishers. And then I said, "Well, how do people know whether they want to buy them?" And he said, "Well, there are people called critics. And they get a free copy. And they read it. And then they say in the newspaper whether it's any good." And I thought, this isn't true. It can't be true. I thought he was just telling me the old story.
You didn't realize that so many people would have a hand in your book.
I did not.
7 or 8? So you must
yes, as young as that.
Been a very precocious child to have such ambitions.
Yes, I suppose in some ways I was slightly precocious. I used to tell stories to my younger brother and sister. I think I knew I wanted to write books, you know, as early as I knew what a book was.
Now, I know from the publicity material you were born in Oxford. Were your parents academics?
No, not at all. My father, I'm in a way almost ashamed to say, worked in the income tax department of the Inland Revenue. And considering my feelings about the income tax, it's probably slightly ironic. And he moved about a lot. I think my parents were rather restless. They liked moving house. Some people do. So we moved fairly frequently.
So you did not grow up in Oxford?
No. I suppose I was about 5 or 6 when they moved from Oxford and went to the Welsh Borders, and another very beautiful city. And then when I was 11, they moved again to Cambridge. And I was at the girls' high school there, so I suppose most of my girlhood was at Cambridge.
Well, they had good taste in their locales.
I grew up in 3 very beautiful cities.
Well, it's strange that you are critical of the British income tax system. Of course, everybody is critical of everybody's tax system.
Absolutely, we all are.
But you also became a public servant at one point in your life,
yes.
Didn't you?
Oh, yes, indeed. I was a bureaucrat. When I had my first job, I went into the British Health Service, and I was an administrator there. This was a very useful experience for at least 2 of my books. And then after my husband died, I took an examination for the public service, and I was successful. So I went into the Home Office, which, as I'm sure you know, is really the equivalent of the Ministry of Justice or the Ministry of the Interior. And I served first in the Peace Department, where I was concerned with forensic science, and that was useful to me too, and then in the department concerned with criminal law.
What did you do in this capacity or in these capacities?
Well, I find it very difficult to explain to people really what a bureaucrat does do, which of course is
so do bureaucrats.
So do bureaucrats, absolutely. But in the police department with the Forensic Science Service, I mean, I was concerned with the equipment for the laboratories. I was concerned with some staffing aspects of them, finding new premises for new laboratories, answering inquiries about them, finding forensic pathologists for the police. That's never a very easy job because the what are called the Home Office pathologists, of course, are recruited from the hospital service, morbid anatomists, and their hospital colleagues want them to be in their laboratories doing the work of the hospital. They're not very keen if they're trudging over fields in Wellington boots looking at dead bodies for the police. So one had to look for a combination of people who are very good pathologists but also didn't mind being called out at all hours of the day or night to look at decaying bodies in remote parts of the country.
Boy, forensics, what a terrific background for somebody who became a detective writer.
Oh, tremendously. I mean, I'm not a scientist, so I can't say I really understand very much of it. But it does mean that I knew how the service was organized, and also, of course, that I met very many pathologists and forensic scientists, as well as policemen, so that I can always get expert advice very readily when I want it. And in this new book, I do acknowledge the debt I owe to the Metropolitan Police Laboratory, who are always extremely kind to me. And
well, it's a good thing you're not a scientist, because how many scientists write fiction? Not very many.
I don't think many do. C.P. Snow did, didn't he, which is interesting.
Was he was a doctor, wasn't he?
No, he was a
scientist.
Was he a scientist? Yes.
There are a number...
I think he was a physicist. I'm not absolutely sure.
Oh. Well, there are a number of doctors who became very good writers.
Yes, there are, aren't there?
And,
yes.
Snow, I remember Snow. I remember my favorite book by Snow was one I must have read 30 years ago, which I remember, well, I don't remember all the substance of it, but I remember the images and the feeling. It was called The Masters.
Oh, I think it's his best.
And in a genteel atmosphere, this struggle among the professors.
Oh, absolutely.
Tooth and nail.
Oh, yes. All this wonderful sort of dining in hall and all the old port and the candles and underneath the knives are out, aren't they, the whole time.
I think I have a Penguin paperback of that in my storage room where all of my teenage books and young adult books or books that stem to that era are stored.
I would agree with you, Don, entirely. I think that is his best.
You are still a bureaucrat, aren't you, in effect?
No. Well, no. I resigned from the Home Office at the end of 79, which was 6 months before I was due, in fact, to retire. 60 is the retiring age. I left at 79.
I was thinking of you're being a magistrate, but I guess that's not the
No, it
bureaucrat.
Isn't really. No, it's quite different. It's a purely judicial job.
Well, what does it take to become a magistrate in London?
Well, you have to be recommended to the Lord Chancellor, and you're appointed by the Lord Chancellor.
That's all?
Well, you have to go in front of a pretty strict selection committee, make sure you've got what he describes as a judicial mind, and that you're fair, and that you're unprejudiced. You then take the oath of allegiance. You take a special oath as a magistrate. You then do training in law, but you're not expected to be a lawyer. You're supposed to represent the general public. And you have a lawyer to assist you in court on all matters of law. And you sit three at a time, and we judge about, well, over 90% of all criminal cases are judged in the lower court. We are the lower court. And, of course, we're also a sort of court examining magistrates, what you would call your grand jury, for the more serious crimes will come to us first and then be committed to the Crown Court for trial.
So you don't actually try cases?
Oh, yes.
You do?
Oh, yes, but not serious cases.
Misdemeanor
the Crown Court.
Cases?
Well, yes, you say misdemeanors. So, I mean, some of them are quite serious, cases of assault, but we have limited powers. We can't send people to prison for more than 6 months, for example.
So you are, in effect, a citizen jurist.
Yes, we are, yes. It's a very, very curious system. I don't think any other country's got it.
Well, now, we do have a system that is not unlike that in some states. Pennsylvania, for example, a state where I work, Commonwealth, does use a system of aldermen and justices of the peace. Mm. And these people are, for the most part, elected. They do not need to have any judicial background. But I found that they don't have the balances that you have, where you where a lawyer will sit with you.
Oh, yes.
They don't have that in Pennsylvania. So You have essentially people ignorant of the law sitting in positions where they probably shouldn't have been. I've been many years since I worked in Pennsylvania, but I used to see some terrible abuses. And in a way, it's just as well, because these aldermen and these justices of the peace would inevitably bind over to a higher court someone accused of a crime, because they wouldn't know the difference. And then they wouldn't dismiss it because they didn't. They would be afraid to dismiss it. Besides that, there was another abuse. These people were paid by the case. They would get a fee for each case brought before them.
We get no money at all. Only we do it is purely voluntary. That's a very strange system, I must say. And when I say we have a trained lawyer, he advises us on the law. He does not go out to consider the case. And, of course, by the time we're trained, we do know enough law to know, for example, about the rules of evidence, to know how the case is conducted, to know what the hearsay rule is, to know what is admissible and inadmissible. But the law is so complicated that occasionally, you will, when you retire, you will send for your clerk and say, what is the law, you know, in relation to this particular aspect of the case? You do need a trained lawyer there. It's a curious system, but it's a very, very old one. It's over 800 years old. It's one of the earliest acts of Parliament that were ever passed, the Justice of the Peace Act.
Well, the British judicial system is a model for many countries, and indeed the model of our own, so it seems to have been a workable one for Britain.
Yes, there, of course, everyone who's tried by us has the right of appeal to the Crown Court. And in more serious cases, they can choose whether they want to be tried by us or go to the jury. If they're tried by us, we haven't quite the same severe powers to sentence. On the other hand, they often feel if they go to a jury, they might get off.
So how often do you sit?
I only sit about three whole days a month at the moment, sometimes four.
In the evening? During the day?
Oh, no, all day.
All day?
All day, yes.
Ideas? Do you produce ideas for your work from these sessions?
Well, I suppose, really, Don, that everything a writer does, in a way, is just to the mill. But I'm not aware that anything that's happened in court has really given me an idea for a book. But, of course, you're meeting human beings in their infinite diversity, and it can be extremely interesting, because it can be very dull if you have a whole afternoon of motoring offences, speeding, for example.
They don't do that in England.
It's don't speed.
Yes, they do.
Oh.
I was being facetious. In fact, to my horror and shock, a wonderful woman who was in her mid-80s by the name of Margie Cohen, who ran for many years in the city a renowned bookshop known as the House of Books. Mm-hmm. Her father, her husband, Colonel Lewis Cohen, was the first bibliographer of Ernest Hemingway. And she was just killed in London when she was struck by a truck last year. She was on a buying trip. And also she had many clients, Tom Stoppard, the playwright who was a collector of Hemingway, and she would physically take books to him, and she was killed. She told me once that she was never going to retire, that they would have to carry her out of the business, and they certainly did. And unfortunately, it happened in London.
I wonder if she was for a moment confused about this dreadful driving on the wrong side of the road. As she must have come to London many, many times, you'd imagine she would have got used to it. But I think that with many American visitors, it is. I mean, my American friends say they find that they do get into danger because instinctively you're looking in the wrong direction for the traffic.
I hear that it takes only about a day to straighten yourself out.
Yes.
I'm not sure. Well, I want to, if you would, give me a little character profile of Commander Adam Dalgleish, who's one of the more interesting characters in detective fiction. Why, for example, in A Taste for Death, has he found that he has not been able to write poetry? It's been 4 years.
I'm not quite sure why the poetry stopped. I think he's going through some kind of midlife crisis and some kind of professional crisis to an extent. I would say that he's essentially a good professional policeman. He's an extremely intelligent detective. He's also a sensitive and complex human being. He's a poet. I think as he grows older, he's increasingly aware, really, of the harm that his job inevitably does, of the destruction that it causes to the innocent as well as the guilty. He's uncomfortably aware that he uses people's weakness against them, that he has to, that people talk to him and confide in him, and he uses that. I think he's aware that there is potential corruption inherent in any form of human authority, and the police, of course, have great authority. So that although he continues to do his job, these are psychological pressures on him, which I think have their effect and may have had their effect on him as a poet.
Who was the prototype for Adam Dalgliesh?
Well, there wasn't one, Don, in the sense that I've never met an Adam Dalgliesh. I suppose I've met people who have some of his qualities, and I've no doubt that they're qualities that I admire. I think, although I'm not sure I'd like to work for Adam Dalgliesh, I'm sure that I admire Adam Dalgliesh, because otherwise I wouldn't continue to write about him. I mean, I wouldn't, as it were, create a character and carry it through a series of books unless I had considerable sympathy with him. But I think he has got a bit of a splinter of ice in his heart. And he uses his job, he's a very private man, he uses his job, I think, to avoid commitment to other human beings to a large extent.
Now, he has appeared in all but two of your mysteries, isn't that correct?
Yes.
Tell me about the heroine, I don't know if that's the lead character, the protagonist of the others.
My other detective, well, she's Cordelia Gray, and of course she is an amateur. She's very young. She's a very courageous, honest, again very intelligent young woman who inherits a run-down, rather seedy detective agency from a professional policeman who kills himself. It's never been very successful, and when she inherits it, people say to her, it's not a suitable job for a woman. So the first book in which she appears is called An Unsuitable Job for a Woman, and in it she investigates the death of a Cambridge student. It's a book that I wrote very easily. It was the easiest to write of all the books, and in some ways the most enjoyable to write. It wasn't as traumatic to write as this new one, by any manner of means. And I wanted to write about Cambridge in midsummer. She appeared in one other, The Skull Beneath the Skin, which is the book before this one. So that I'm in a happy position, you see, that depending on the crime, I can call in either a professional or an amateur, so that I have the advantage there over New Scotland Yard.
Does writing indeed come easily for you?
Can it be, sorry, darling?
Does it come? You mentioned that your Cordelia Gray book was one of the first one was a book, perhaps the easiest one of your books to write. Does writing generally come easy for you?
Sometimes it does, and sometimes not. It's curious. I think some mornings, and I usually write in the morning, I don't find I can do creative work in the evening. I tend to get tired as the day goes on. Some mornings it flows beautifully. And at the end of the stint, which is usually about 3 hours, I feel, well, that is as good as I can do. I don't mean it's as good as anybody could do, but I can't do this any better. This chapter or this piece is as good as it can be. And other times it needs revising 2, 3, or 4 times. And then there are the odd days when it just doesn't get moving at all. And I imagine that other people who write, not only novelists, find this. I mean, you may find it too. And what one can't make up one's mind about is it better to persevere, even if you're feeling like this, and make sure that you do your stint? Is this a good and right discipline? Or is it a good thing to say, look, you know, today it's no good, let's leave it and come back fresh tomorrow? And I've never made up my mind. But
well, what happens when you reach a dead end? Do you still try to peck away at the typewriter, or what?
I don't reach a dead end ever in the sense that I don't know what's going to happen next, but because with a classical detective story, which is the kind I write, it has to be planned so minutely before I even begin writing that I always know where I'm going. I never have this feeling, well, you know, what on earth will the hero do now? I've got him up against the wall and it's all hopeless. I know what I'm going to write about. It's just that sometimes the writing itself comes much more easily and I think more successfully than others.
You must make an extensive outline so you know exactly when
absolutely
you're going to wind up.
Absolutely, you do. I mean, planning the book and researching it, plotting it, takes as long for me as the actual writing. It's been 4 years since I last published a book. That was The Skull Beneath the Skin. I suppose there was about a year when I didn't do very much writing. And of the other three, 18 months must have been spent on plotting, planning, research, and 18 months in the writing. So it's a long process, really.
And you have so much detail in terms of locales.
Yes.
Do you actually visit places that become the settings for your
book? Absolutely.
The church, for example.
Oh, absolutely.
Vividly pictured.
It's a real church, you see, Don. With me, the book nearly always begins with a place, and with some kind of mental picture, which is very vivid. And this began with a church in Oxford, in England, my younger daughter is married to a don at Oxford, and I was visiting her and my grandchildren, and she took me to see this church. It's a large, rather gaunt Victorian brick church, exactly like the one described in the book. It's by a canal, but in Oxford, with this great bell tower. It is based on a Venetian church. And I uprooted it, as it were, set it down in London, beside the canal there, gave it the same architect. Externally, it's the same. Some of the internal details are rather different. But basically, it is St. Barnabas Church, Oxford, transferred to London. And when I first visited it and went into the vestry, I had this extraordinarily vivid picture of these two murdered bodies. So the book began there. And from then, of course, I had to decide who these two dead men were, and why they'd been killed, and why in that place, and why in that particular manner. So I got my victims and then found what their homes, what their lives were like. And the one of the victims, who is an ex-minister of state and a baronet called Sir Paul Barone, the house in which he lives is a real house. I've set it down in a part of London very near where I live, but in fact it does exist in another part of London. It's now a museum. It's the John Soane Museum. And again, I uprooted it and set it down near me and used it as his house. It seemed the right house. So very often, you know, I am visiting real buildings, real churches, real houses, and certainly real parts of the country in order to set the books.
Well, so A Taste of Death began almost like a portion of the dialogue. I can't remember where it is, but it dealt with the way a poem begins. The poem begins by being a poem, I think, in effect. I think that's, I can't remember exactly who was speaking at the time.
But poetry begins with a line of poetry.
Yes, it begins that way. So in a way, the novel began that way too, didn't it?
Yes, it did. It's a very, very curious sensation, perhaps that's the word, writing, because what I sometimes feel is that I'm not really creating the characters in the sense that I sit down and say, well, write. What shall I make him like? What shall I make her like? Shall I make her jealous? Shall I make her beautiful? Shall, you know, make rich, poor? What shall she be like? It's rather as if all the characters exist already outside myself or in some limbo of the subconscious. And what I'm really doing is getting in touch with them and getting them down in black and white. I've heard other writers say that that's how it seems to them.
Well, it's interesting to me. This question's probably been directed to you and which you probably don't like too much, and I can understand why, and perhaps I'm wrong because I haven't done an analysis per se, but it seems to me that the best mystery writers, the writers with the best names, tend to be women. I mean, there's Dorothy Sayers, and there's Rendell, and Mary Roberts Rinehart, and Highsmith, and Christie, and
Christie.
James, and it seems to me that in some respects, women have claimed the mystery field for themselves.
I think this is largely true if we think of a particular kind of mystery. Of course, there's been some absolutely magnificent writing by men, particularly here in America, what we call the hard-boiled school. I mean, if you think of Dashiell Hammett, Raymond Chandler, Ross MacDonald, really wonderful, wonderful novelists. But it's a different kind of mystery. If we're thinking of the classical, rather gentle detective story, perhaps gentle seems the wrong word to use when we're talking about violent death, but the book set in a community of people, a village, a small town, malice domestic. We often talk about it set in the imaginary village of Mayhem Parva. Here women have excelled. And I think possibly because we have an eye for detail, and so much clue-making requires an eye for detail. Partly, I think, because we're interested in the characterization rather more than the weaponry or the action. Murder is an extraordinarily disruptive crime, and I think it seems to we women that human beings, as it were, paint over their lives a kind of coat of varnish. And when murder happens, it's all blown apart, and you see the essential man, the essential woman. Or it may simply be, you know, that we like the structure. It's a very formal structure, isn't it? We have central mysterious death, closed suspect, circle of suspects. We have a detective, amateur or professional, who comes in to solve the crime. At the end of the book, we have a solution. So it's a very firmly structured novel. And it may possibly be that women like the security of the structure, and that working within it, we can explore themes which otherwise we may not feel competent to explore.
Well, your writing is a little different from some of the others in terms of the more psychological aspects or motivations of the characters, but also you write, well, in the case of the murders, much more vividly. I mean, there's much more blood and gore. I mean, it seems to me that many of the other writers have kind of just said, well, there's a body on the floor, and it's...
Yes. It's,
it's Colonel Blimp, but you go into a certain... That must be the forensic background that you had.
I wonder. Yes, I think my daughters find it rather distressing. They always say, can't read this bit, Mummy. And my poor dear mother really found it very difficult to read. I don't think it's because I'm particularly fascinated by the blood and gore. I think it's because I'm trying to write a realistic novel. And murder is uniquely horrifying and dreadful. And, of course, if people have their throats cut, it's also very bloody. And I think the scene or the chapter in which the body or bodies are discovered is a very important chapter, and it's always seen through the eyes of the character who actually makes the discovery. And of course it's an absolutely horrifying moment for that character, and I think it should be a fairly horrifying moment for the reader too. I mean, I don't think it's just sufficient for me to say, here, remember, these bodies are found by a church worker called Miss Wharton and a little boy. It wouldn't be just sufficient to say Miss Wharton opened the door and was amazed or horrified or astounded to find two dead bodies. I mean, I try to express exactly the horror that she felt, which does mean some, I think, fairly detailed, explicit description.
Now, a moment ago you mentioned the hard-boiled mystery, which seems to be an American creation. Do you like that sort of mystery?
I wouldn't say it was my favorite kind of mystery, no. But I do admire the writing very much, and I think they're very interesting. But I don't reread them in the way that I'll reread the gentler English stories of, say, Dorothy L. Sayers or Marjorie Allingham or Niall Marsh.
There's a mystery writer in this country whose dialogue is superb. His books have a tendency to be redundant, I think, in some respect. But his name is Elmore Leonard, and his dialogue is absolutely magnificent. He has a tendency to capture the way people speak and the dialects. Mm. And he would be one I think would be interesting to you.
Yes, I think he would, and I shall certainly read him, because I think this is a tremendously important gift to be able to write dialogue that both carries the story forward and, in fact, you know, reveals character.
Well, my last question, P.D. James, you got off, according to the publicity material here, to a rather late start as a writer. You were almost 40, or at least to have a published book, in spite of your dreams as a little girl, 8 or 7, that you wanted to be a writer. But it does prove that there is no such thing as a prohibition against one becoming older and not being able to do what you have done. How does this feel?
Well, I suppose, Don, in some ways, I wish I had started earlier. I won't bore you with all the reasons why I didn't, but being 19 when the war broke out was certainly one of them, not a good time to start a book. But I wish I'd started earlier, I have to admit that. But I think that it does mean that people who want to write can begin writing at any age. I never had a rejection slip, and I think possibly this was because I was a fairly late starter. Had I begun earlier, I might have had to go through that rather traumatic experience of having rejection slips. So I would say to anyone who wants to write, write. This is really one art form when it is never too late to begin.
There's still hope for me, then, to write the great American novel. Or any novel.
Well, you're still a young man, you lucky thing.
P.D. James, what a treat having you in. Thank you very, very much for coming and talking to me.
Thank you very much for having me, John.